these themes I was mentoring, these recurrent themes in the Book of Mormon, you notice each one of them would be a good subject for the final examination. We only give one test here. We just have to write a paper at the end, and that's worked out best. I've tried every other combination. My daughter's just telling me this Friday she takes her final examination for PhD at Harvard, and she says it's funny. She can get a book absolutely down cold. She can recite it word for word. She has a marvelous memory. Long enough for the examination, but after that's over, it's forgotten. Well, you all know that experience. But I notice when you write these papers, and they get better and better. The last two semesters, I've had marvelous papers. You wouldn't believe, awfully good. You'd never forget, believe what would come out of this class. And when you have a paper like that, then you want to live with it. People come and ask for it again, and they take it seriously. You've actually learned something. Now, good subjects, what's a good subject for this final? Well, all of these things we've mentioned would be a good one. For example, first of all, the idea of destruction, the geological and the historical cycles, and it's the theme in the Book of Mormon. It rings all through the Book of Mormon. You think there was not room for anything else until you start reading it, and then you find there's room for everything, all sorts of other themes. But here, it is the theme, venit summa dies et una lictabile tempus, fuimus Troyes. That day has finally come that we knew should come because of our imperfections. You see, we break down, and anything which isn't perfect isn't going to last. You notice that? The slightest flaw. That's why we must come here and get baptized and wash away our sins and achieve perfection, and then we're no good at all. Then through the atoning blood of Christ, we have to get cleaned up because we're getting ready for the long pull. There's a long time ahead, whether it's eternity or not. Let's just cut it off at 300 billion years, for example. That's quite a while. Now, if you have flaws in your character, they're going to raise hell in that time, in very little time. They show very quickly, as you know. If you have imperfections in your character, a building with a flaw in it, it's an amazing thing. You may have seen the way New York is falling apart. I think it was in the last 60 minutes. Bridges and sewers and the underground, all the things, all are collapsing. Take $50 billion to restore them. Because of little flaws in them. They thought they would last for a long time. They're all solid concrete, steel, and so forth. But the whole thing is just collapsing. Because this is mortality. Things have flaws in this earth. And one little flaw, one little leak, and you're on your way to destruction. So we have to think in terms of perfection, which is a long way off. And so we're faced with this constant destruction. We're constantly being oxidized. We're all being burned up in a slow furnace 24 hours a day. So when the announcement comes, Aeneas says, the final day has come that we knew must come. You've all read The Idylls of the King. That's the theme there, isn't it? These idealists, they're going to have an order, the order of the round table that's going to last for thousands of years. Well, it'll only last for less than one generation because of the flaws of character of the people, no matter how small they are. And so you have to be ready and resigned to it, as Achilles says when he's about to knock off somebody, the youngest son of Troy, of Priam, as a matter of fact. Alephilos thanakaisu, tie olephuriai hutos, katanakai patroclus operseo polonomeron. All right, my boy, there's nothing, everybody has to die sometime. He says you might as well enjoy it. And so he says, why are you raising such a rumpus? Patroclus died, who is a much better man than you. So remember that. And the same thing, fortes ante Agamemnon. Fortes erant anca. There were great men, there were brave men before Agamemnon. Perhaps the men of an earlier time were better than we are. Well, that we talked about the constant decline because things run downhill. That's entropy and so on. So destruction's a great theme, and the Book of Mormon, it hits it all the time. How can we get around it? How can we avoid being depressed by it? Then there's the problem of survival. Now, survival's a dirty word. That means I'm going to be here after everybody else is gone. It's going to be pretty dismal then. You might want to survive, you see. Then you wish you were dead. The great Christian father of the 5th century, I may have mentioned this last time, they had a great earthquake in Antioch, just wiped everything out. But before the earthquake, everybody was saying, this was the ironical thing, well, it was the me generation. He says, that's what's destroyed us. Everybody's out for himself. It's me generation, and this is the philosophy of our time, too. And everybody would say, there was a common joke in Antioch, I wish there was an earthquake in Antioch and kill everybody else but me, then I'd be the richest man in Antioch. See, that's what you want. That's what you want. Wipe out all opposition. Use hostile takeovers, crush them, knock them out, and so forth. Those are policies that are used today. And then you'll be the one on top, and you'll be the lone survivor, and it won't be wonderful to survive. No, it won't be. But this idea, but it's the Rechabite motive, you see. Fata profugus laveni aquamenit. He's driven by fate. All the great men are wanderers, strangers like Abraham. He's a stranger and wanderer on the earth looking for a city which was built and made and builded without hands, a city of God built without hands, and so on. Abraham is called a refugee every year, well, especially the seventh year, but every year, every Jew could come to the temple and make a basket of all the good things from representative of all, like a cornucopia, of all the good things from his land, the blessings that his land had given him. And then he says a prayer, and he says, our father Abraham was an outcast and a Syrian, a tramp and a wanderer, who had no home. That's what the word Hebrew means. Everit means a person who has no attachments, a displaced person, you see. And the Israelites are always displaced persons. Abraham wandered. He never had his grave. He had to rent his grave from a Phoenician, you see, in Hebron there. He didn't have anything of his own. He was a stranger, depending on other people's bounty wherever he went. But, of course, depending on God wherever he went. Our father Abraham was a stranger, a wanderer, and a tramp, and so were we all. We used to sing a hymn, I'm a stranger, I'm a pilgrim, and so forth, and that's our condition. Now, that survival, the Rechabite motif in the Book of Mormon, is very important, too. You notice that. It comes out all the time that we're all refugees and we're all... And after all, look how mobile our society is. How many of you live in the same home your grandparents lived in? See? That used to be the normal thing, you see. Of course you lived in the home your grandparents lived in. When I was in Germany, we had a meeting house in Salzgasse number 9. It was an old Roman street in Bruxelles, a very ancient town. This Salzgasse number 9, this house had been occupied by Sister Glick's family for 1,000 years or so. All sorts of vicissitudes had happened, but these things happened. And the found Sister Teresa Harvey's house, in the first house ever dated by ring dating, tree ring dating, is in Walpi, in the Hopi village of Walpi, up on the peak there, the first mesa. And Sister Teresa Harvey was the one who revived the making of the ancient pottery and so forth. This house was dated to the 11th century, about 800 years, and they've been occupying that house for all that time. They've been up there all that time, been solid, very enduring, very lasting civilization. This is what civilization is. Extremely stable, and ours is extremely unstable. See? All you have to do is look at the fluctuations of the Dow Jones. Nobody knows what makes it go up or down. If you do, you're guaranteed to be rich. You could become fabulously rich if you could be sure. That's why insider trading is such a crime, because you tip somebody off, and then he can be sure about what's going to happen in a certain thing. But we can never be sure. That's why I say why the stock market moves. And as long as it moves up and down and up and down, it's been doing some great things in both directions. It's a very insecure society. We're on shaky pins. We don't know where we're going. We're moving a product that may go over big now will be no good a little later on. We talked about the things that passed away, the sailing boats that used to sail the sea in my day, and so forth. Imagine that. So this idea of survival, the Rechabite motif, and the Book of Mormon deals with it all the time, because they're always running away and they're always surviving. This is the land of promise, another theme. The Lord says, if you want to be saved, you have to get out. Lehi has a dream, he must get out. Nephi has a dream, he must get out. Mosiah has a dream, he must get out. You must get out of here. It isn't safe where you are. You have to keep moving. It's business of surviving. It has to be more than survival. Nice subject for a paper, though. This idea about the record, how the record, the books hold it together. There's another theme you mentioned, you see. The book is a mnemonic device. There's a great deal said about memory and the importance of memory. The purpose of a book, of writing, of course, is, as the Book of Mormon tells us, is to keep in the people's memory, to keep in memory the things that the Lord wants them to know. That's why it's given to them. He says, if we had to write these things from memory, our record would not be reliable. So we hand these, no matter how good your memory is, you have to write down things, and the writing of the record, but the record holds everything together. Your identity is your memory. We see, if you lose your memory, you lose your identity. I did for a while back in 1964. Had sort of a minor stroke or something like, forgot absolutely everything. Lost identity and everything else. The remarkable thing is the way it came back, improved as a matter of fact. This is a strange thing. They tell us that too, in their writing on the brain, Sir John Eccles. There are two miracles of the brain, and one is that you concentrate on one thing. You can't think on more than two things at a time. Just one thing you can't think on two. But you concentrate, and yet this background, you can think of everything at the same time. The other is that you, and this is Popper and Eccles that wrote this book. They cooperated on it. Popper is a positivist, an absolute science, wants no nonsense at all, but they agreed that the most miraculous thing in the world is that you wake up in the morning. They say that's just as miraculous as the resurrection would be. That you can blank out at night, that you can change your brain, just let your brain go, and come back complete, and your whole person is there the next morning after you slipped away. It's quite a miracle. Lord says, don't be too astounded with the resurrection. Just when it happens, you say, so what? Exactly. You don't believe a thing can happen until it does happen, and it looks like the most normal thing in the world. Ah, Kunstdick inventor, famous German joke. So write about the record and about memory. If we forget, this is why we need the record and so forth. We say, no, we're looking toward the future. We're not time-bound. We're not bound in the past and so forth. But the past is all we have to show for our existence. That's all you have. If you forget the past, where do you stand? You're a person without identity. You're beginning life. And we had an extremely stupid but beautiful girl in the class, and Charlie Wilson used to say, back at Scripps College in Claremont, California, a very expensive girls' school where he used to teach. And anyway, this girl, beautiful girl, and Charlie used to say, isn't she marvelous? She's born new every morning. Complete blank every day. He's born new every morning. Because if you lose your memory, that's what happens. And so we don't read today, and we don't know what's behind us. And we say, this is the great disaster that's coming upon us today, because we have no feeling of identity of ourself, no national identity, so we have to wave flags and do all sorts of very superficial and artificial clowning to remind ourselves, a great nation, we have to put on military displays and so forth that lead to nothing but trouble. And so... We don't have a feeling. And you notice there are civilizations, and this is a very important thing, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. And this is very strong in the Book of Mormon. As you know, they're constantly talking about keeping the record alive and keeping their traditions alive and so forth. Well, you can write about that too. And then the gospel plans. I say the Book of Mormon has more, better expositions, more clear. Mark, it's the only statements, these sermons you find in the Book of Mormon, you have half a dozen of them, and they're great. And some of them are the only ones, like Alma talked to his son, Coriantumr. He is the only person who tells us what happens after this, you see. Is there something? Yes, he says, I know, I went there, and it was hell because I hadn't been doing right, but I had to go through and so forth. But there is more, you see, but it tells us the whole plan. It's laid out throughout the Book of Mormon, all these passages here where... explain right at the beginning, Jacob is told how it's going to be after their greatest victory. Nephi can prophesy and so forth. So this gospel plan, it's temporal, it's for here, and it is eternal. It goes for the eternities. And it's, they live after the manner of happiness, the gospel plan. What a marvelous thing to say. There is a manner of happiness and what it is like, because nobody else has it. See, now remember, you can have everything here, and this is the theme we haven't mentioned here, the Book of Mormon, that of materialism and so forth. It piles up. But remember the Buddha. He was the son of a great prince and local prince, but a very rich one, and had everything he wanted. And his father particularly spoiled him because he didn't want him to become mystic and join the priests or anything like that. So he gave him everything the heart of man could desire. The food, the play, the games, the sex, all the rest of it, you see. And he was sick. It made him sick. He didn't know. He just brooded about it. He was not satisfied with it. He went out into the woods, and finally he'd have to find nothing. And what was he looking for? And the only conclusion he could reach, the five conditions in which you were nothing. Don't want anything, and you won't be disappointed. Don't expect anything. There is no hereafter. There is no nothing. Once you get that idea, nyeti, nyeti, nothing, nothing, then nothing will worry you. Nothing, of course it won't, yes. You might as well put a bullet through your head, then nothing will worry you either. But that was it, you see. The religions of the East, they promise us that. Don't expect anything, and you won't be disappointed. The very same problem was faced by Enos, that marvelous Book of Enos. And what character... there's another study you could write about, character studies in the Book of Mormon. There are at least 20 sharply defined, clearly pictured characters, beautiful little vignettes. Character, just in a few lines, a few verses, it brings out the character very clearly, very sharply. Just what makes this person tick. And Enoch was a marvelous example. So was Nephi. What a neurotic Nephi was. Worried himself sick. But it was the same thing. Remember, he all day long he brooded. He'd had everything in his life, and he was worried about himself. He hadn't been doing right. And he says, this can't be what I'm here for. Then he finally remembered what his father had told him, you see, about these things. And then he prayed all night for it. He tried again. This must be it, you see. But the whole thing was, he said, this can't go on. I can't live like this. He went alone to hunt beasts in the forest, to relax. Remember, he was a prince. He was a spoiled prince. And he had everything, and it wouldn't do at all. And he finally, of course, and he had the vision, the Lord came to him and so forth. But the same thing with Enos and Harun al-Rashid, a famous story. Harun al-Rashid was the most sumptuous, the greatest of all the princes. And, of course, he's the hero of the 1001 Nights, of the Arabian Nights. But, of course, he has everything, and the Arab does that. They know how to live it up. I mean, as we see by the Arab Sheikhs, whoever dreamed they'd be the richest people in the world, who were the poorest people. They were dirt sand when I was over there at first. Had nothing but sand to eat. It was terrible. But Harun al-Rashid had something, and he would... long stories of how at night he would try to amuse himself. He'd do everything he could think of. And his faithful servant, the black man, giant black man by the name of Ja'far, did his best to entertain him. He said, what can we do? Well, they'd dress up as like Prince Hal would and go around at night and visit all the stews and places like that and have fun, disguise themselves and fool people and find out what was going on. That would amuse them. But he goes through his gardens. They don't amuse him. He listens to the nightingale. Well, I've had enough of that. The harem, 50 women, what do you want? And so forth. This went on. But see, the point is Harun al-Rashid is absolutely sick because he has too much. He has everything, you see. And this idea of the gospel plan, well, after all, how weary, flat, stale, and another prince, you'll recognize this one, and unprofitable are to me all the uses of this world. Fie on it, oh fie. 'Tis an unweeded garden that goes to seed. Things rank and gross possess it merely. He wants to commit suicide, you see. We could go on about Hamlet. He feels that way. It's rank and gross. What is this worth, you see? Goes so heavily with my disposition that this little looker, he says, is to me nothing but a sterile promontory. He goes on and on about it. Well, we won't give you that speech now. But that's the same thing with him, you see. You have everything. That's not going to be it, of course. Of course, this brings in the subject of materialism and the fatal gong that strikes in the Book of Mormon when it says, they set their hearts on riches. Oh, look out when it says that. Of course, and does this apply to us? And then there's the ethnic mix. Here's another one you could write about. The Book of Mormon is a crazy quilt of ethnic mixture, and we have always been so simplistic about it, you know. Everything you found was either, when I was a little kid, everything you found was either Nephite or Lamanite. Well, of course, that's not so at all. According to the Book of Mormon, it's not. It talks of vacant lands, of people that had been there, of vast areas deforested by the former inhabitants of the land, and they weren't Jaredites either. This was down in the Southlands and so forth. And they used to teach in the church, actually, that the Rocky Mountains here were formed because, after all, the Book of Mormon says there was a great storm and some of the earth was cast up. It gives a perfect example. Of course, they were volcanic. Perfect example of a number 8 on the Richter scale, a humdinger of an earthquake. In all details, it gives a beautiful analysis of it as we get to that. But that doesn't mean the Rocky Mountains were formed. We used to leap to those conclusions. If it isn't, we used to, like Hillary said of the Bible, anything that isn't mentioned in the Bible, you can safely say never happened, because the Bible is the perfect book, of course. If it's not mentioned in the Bible, it didn't happen. Well, fundamentalist Christianity isn't too far away from that either. They preach the same nonsense as that. And so don't get this ethnic mix business that it's so simple. Remember, how do you start out? Oh, I would have brought a book from 1830. I have a book at the same time. A beautiful exposition, an American writing, showing that the Indians all came over the Bering Strait. And notice that simplistic theory is still accepted now. There's a series running on Channel 7 right now on the Chaco and the Maya and so forth. And especially the newly discovered sensation of the Wendover Indians, who were in Florida 5,000 BC, 7,500 years ago. Well, does that clash with the Book of Mormon? No, it doesn't. Get to that. You look at the Book of Mormon ethnology, and you'll find out about that. But the, it starts out, you notice. Lehi is of what tribe? Is of Manasseh. Well, who is Manasseh's mother? Ephraim and Manasseh, we're descended from Ephraim. Ephraim and Manasseh were the sons of Asenath. Joseph and Asenath. Joseph married Asenath. And she was the daughter of the high priest of Heliopolis, pure-blood Egyptian. She had to be. So our ancestress, our ancestor of Ephraim, is Egyptian, is Egyptus. Don't worry about that. Is Asenath. But that gets a terrific mixture because the Egyptians are already, you see, a mixture of at least seven different lines. Asenath was at least seven, and when you get into Judah, but remember, they were half Manasseh. They were on the other side of the Jordan. They were desert Arabs. They all had Arab names and so forth, as you find in the Book of Mormon. And he marries up with Ishmael. Now, a Jew isn't going to be called Ishmael, because Ishmael was the enemy, remember, of Jacob. And that he is the hero of the Arabs. He was anciently called Ishmael, was the father of the Arabs, and he is. And he and his daughters marry, he has his daughters marry up with the sons of Lehi. You can be darn sure they're Ishmaelites, because Lehi himself, you see, is a desert man. He's a merchant, travels in the desert. And this would be his cousin. He would be an Ishmaelite. And then they take Zoram. Now, the name Zoram, he was a servant of Laban, as you know. But a Jew can't be a servant of slave. He was a slave. It calls him a slave another. He can't be a slave of another Jew. Zoram, as his name shows, he was obviously of some other tribe. He could very well have been one of the Canaanite tribes, Canaanitish. A Phoenician or anything else. They all have these. Right from the beginning, you get this terrific mixture in the family of Lehi, and then they start mixing up, and then throughout the Book of Mormon, you'll find all sorts of mixing going on, strange things. That's a good subject, that ethnic mix. Then this theme of the Promised Land. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, every blessing, bracha, goes with the cursing, alalak, because that's the penalty. In a contract, you have to have a penalty clause. If you don't keep the contract, you say, well, that's fine. If I keep the contract, I get rich and so forth. I don't keep it, no loss, nothing less. Well, when you invest in a thing like that, you have to be kept to something. And the Promised Land is never mentioned without the curse that's on there. There is a promise on the land, and the curse is often mentioned, not often, but sometimes mentioned first. The curse is mentioned first. There's a curse on this land. If you do not live up to it, then it shall be. When you're ripe in iniquity, only then, you see, when it's ripe in iniquity, when you're ripe, when the fruit is ripe, there's no reason for letting it go on rotting. You see, then is the time you have to pick it. Or when the cup is full, when your cup of iniquity is full, then you can add no more to it. You can't dilute it. You cannot take the poison out of it. When the cup is full, then the time. But when that time comes, it says, then the inhabitants shall be swept from the land. You shall become extinct, is the word that's used. This doesn't happen in other nations. This is a special curse on the Promised Land. I say the Greeks and the Arabs and the Egyptians are still there, and the Hindus, the Chinese, they were ancient nations when Lehi left Jerusalem. They're still there, still speak their language, still have their culture. But what about the cultures that were on America? Nobody can even guess about. No one has the wildest guess about what was going on in the time of Christ, 2000 BC, in this country. You can't even begin to guess that. So, I mean, it's perfectly wild. They know all you have to do is see all the American archaeologies, because you have no written records. They have nothing like that. They haven't found the big stuff yet. I'm sure they'll find it and so forth. So it's different in this country. They have disappeared. The ruins are there, magnificent ruins, and some of the people, like the Mayan, are still there and still speak. But they lost all connection with the past. It's all gone, you see. Their nation's from the dust. And you notice how often the Book of Mormon uses that dust, from the dust, whispering from the dust, these voices, the nations that have passed. It's very sad, see, when it starts out. These nations, this is a voice that comes to you. And nothing sadder than the ending, nothing sadder than the beginning. When you get this record, you shall know. And then, so we have the Promised Land and the migration times. The people are always migrating, but they all always doing that anyway. But here we always migrate. We always keep going. As I say, you're not living in your grandparents' houses. We not only move individually in families, but we also move by mass. There are mass movements toward the Southwest since World War II, and the great movement toward the Sun Belt. And it changes culture, it changes habits and everything else. We're always changing. But you reach a certain point of corruption, and now the means are at hand, you see, by which the whole thing, the whole earth can be swept clean. Be swept from the face of the earth. That's the promise. And of course, anciently there were. You don't have to have modern technology to do that. You can do that quite efficiently, because fire will have the same effect once you set it. And the Assyrians were very good at that. The Romans were very good at that, of making empty lands, of producing wildernesses. Incidentally, that's another theme. Ooh, I left it out of this list here. The wilderness theme. The beauties of living, the importance of living in the... Now, you notice, at least half of the Book of Mormon takes place in the wilderness. It's always the good people that are in the wilderness. And when they go to the city, into the woods, my master went, clean for spent, and so forth. You go into the woods to clean yourself up. You have to go back to nature to make yourself clear. And they do that, you know. Lehi and Nephi would always go out by himself to pray, and Joseph Smith, where was the revelation given? In the grove, of course. He went to the grove. And he starts out, his story was discovered in 1969, the oldest version of the first vision, and how he got onto it. He says he lived in the most beautiful area, that upstate New York. It's gorgeous there. You still go there. But then it was a wilderness. It was marvelous. He says when he looked about it, saw what a beautiful world it is, the sun and the moon, and all nature in its glory, and so forth, and man walking forth upon the face of the earth with all his potential and glory. And then he said, when I looked upon, this is when he was just a kid, 14 years old, he says, when I looked upon the wickedness and the dissensions and the vileness and the deceptions and the meanness and the cruelty of men, he says, there's something definitely wrong. And that's what first sent him to the Bible and sent him out to the grove to ask what was going on, you see. And there the Lord told him, behold, the world at this time lies in sin. And there is none that doeth good, no, not one. And mine anger is kindling against the inhabitants of the earth to visit them according to this, their ungodliness. My anger is kindling, getting hotter and hotter. It's building up. You know, we're living in some time, you see. We need the Book of Mormon more than anything else. This is the handbook we have, because it's a happy book, too. This is the nice thing. It's after the manner of happiness. You can live after the manner of happiness among the worst conditions. This was somewhat parallel. You notice when the Greeks produced their greatest, their best comedies and their best tragedies and their best poetry was when Athens was hiding behind walls under siege by Spartan strong coalition and so forth. The plague had broken out in the city. They hadn't any food. It was terrible conditions. Then when they produced their greatest masterpieces, remarkable thing, you see. So maybe we'll have a chance to produce some masterpieces if we stay around. Let's hope not, eh? But that's an important theme now, the wilderness. You escape it. Now, you all know, sweet are the uses of adversity. This starts out, you see, here the Duke. We'll give his speech. You'll see what it is. He sucks. They're out in the woods, and it's wintertime. Remember, As You Like It takes place in winter, under the bleakest circumstances. Shakespeare's very fond of that, having people go back to the wilderness. When they're disillusioned, they go back. King Lear does, you know. They go back, and in As You Like It, they do the same sort of thing. And the Duke says, how now? Now, my comates and brothers in exile, hath not old custom made this life more sweet than that of painted pomp? He's even a powerful Duke. Are not these woods more free of peril than the envious court? There's where the danger is. Not out in the woods. They're starving to death and they're freezing. He's shivering around. They're skimming around a little fire, and the Duke is covered with furs and they're all shaking like it. What a place, what a way for a comedy to begin, you see. It's in a bleak situation. Then painted pomp. Here feel we but the penalty of Adam. We're back to fundamentals, elemental things now. The seasons change, which as the sharp tooth and chiding, yes, sharp tooth and chiding chill of winter, chiding winter's chill, which when it beats and blows upon my body, even till I shrink with cold, he says, I smile and say, these are no flatterers. These counselors, this is no flattery. He says, this is no flattery, which is all he got when he was back in office. These counselors feelingly teach me what I am. And then comes the speech we all know, sweet are the uses of adversity, which like the toad, ugly and venomous, it looks bad. There's yet a precious jewel in his head. And this our life exempt from public haunts. You get away from it, exempt. If you want to see honesty and see things the way they are, you must get away from the public haunts, exempt from public haunts. Finds tongues in trees, marvelous, instructed by everything, books in running books, sermons in stones, and good in everything. I would not change it, he says. So then he has to go out to that sort of thing. We find a lot of that here. So the wilderness theme, better put that one down here too. That's a good, because you're always doing it in the Book of Mormon. You always, when they run out, you see, I say, when Alma or Enoch or Ether, it's not Ether, it's Jared, excuse me, Book of Ether. When Jared or Lehi, I say, or Nephi, or Ammon, or Alma, or whoever it is, runs away. It's always to the wilderness. You can go out, get away from people if you can. Well, can we get away from people? Well, I say, we can arrange artificial wildernesses today. We're very, very good at doing that. And then we have the theme of the routine apostasy. Must it always happen? You say the individual is without excuse, but they always apostatize. We're going to get a very good article. speech on that in the chapter we're studying today, the 46th chapter, which we'll soon get to, believe it or not. The theme of prophecy, in the book. Now, the Book of Mormon has some marvelous prophecies, and it's for the people of Lehi, and it's for us. When you read the Book of Mormon, keep an eye open for prophecy. It's loaded with it. It's all over the place, and it's very clear. Then we have those great sermons and so forth. Well, these are some of the main themes we've got in the first 45 chapters. Now we start with chapter 46. If this 46th chapter was the only one we had, it would be quite enough to prove the Book of Mormon. I mean, evidence to convince a person. It really would. So let's open to 46 here. And we get a lot of surprises. It's extremely rich in evidence as far as that goes. But notice what the situation is here. Naturally, you must read what goes before. See, you have to have a memory, otherwise you're nowhere here. There'd been a great war, and they'd been saved by the skin of their teeth, by the genius of Moroni, mostly. And after the war, there was a post-war boom. The end of chapter 45, everybody got very rich. And notice, we start with the 21st verse. Because of the wars with the Lamanites, many little dissensions and disturbances, lots of troubles everywhere because things had got uncorrelated and so forth, like the church in Europe after World War II. Strange things had grown up. Strange leaders have taken over, arguments about doctrine. People lost touch, you see. That's what happens when you don't have the central, when you don't have the written record, when you don't have the controls. And this happened in Europe in almost all countries where they were left alone to their own resources. You start little groups of dissent. There'd be arguments in the branch, power struggles, and little things like that. This is what happened during this long war, a 14-year war, mind you. Many dissensions and disturbances. So they had to make a regulation made throughout the church, a single regulation. The central head had to take over, central authority, which you have to do, of course. That's why you have the church, the central offices, and so forth. And so Helaman and his brethren, Helaman being the son of Alma, of course, and his brethren went forth to establish the church again. They went to straighten things up. But the people didn't want to pay any attention to Helaman. Things were going too good after the war. They felt a sigh of relief and wanted to take it easy. The 23rd verse in the 46th chapter we're on now at the end, it says, they would not give heed to the words of Helaman and his brethren. Why not? After the war. But they grew proud. Now remember, this was written by a 23-year-old in the 1820s in upstate New York. Now, people knew nothing about this course of history, but this is the course that history has taken in our day. This is what you might expect to happen after a great war, but who doubted all this all figured out? And so this is what happened. And it sounds very familiar, doesn't it, where it says, they grew proud, being lifted up in their hearts because of their exceeding great riches. Great prosperity. It's an interesting phenomenon, you know, the great wars of extermination that took place in Central Asia, Genghis Khan, Kublai Khan, and so forth, they would just wipe out whole nations. The funny thing is, after those great exterminations, or after the plague in Europe, there always comes a boom period. The release, apparently it relieves population pressure or something, but because great prosperity always follows, there's always a big market for things, there is always lots of raw material around, and labor is expensive because the workers are few. See, after the Great Plague in the middle of the 14th century, 1340, 48, only lasted a few years, three or four years in England. It lingered on here and there. But so many of the people were killed off that the farm workers could now ask for a raise in pay because there were fewer of them. So immediately, they cracked down the crown, cracked down Edward I, cracked down with the most severe, Henry III, wasn't it? The most severe laws prohibiting any wage raise. It must be, you have to take the wage you get. And that led to the peasants' revolt shortly after that, led by Jack Cade and so forth. Well, that's time of Richard II. And Richard II took the side of the peasants. The landowners were too tough for him. This theme goes on, you see. After the Great War, we get, or the plague or whatever, then there's great disturbance and terrific economic booms and great greed. It's a good example, you see, because here there were only about a third of the workers left, and so they wanted to get a rise in pay because they had more work to do and they had better opportunities. And they passed a law, A1, you should not leave the farm, you must never leave the land you're on, and you must never ask for a raise. In other words, stay the way you are forever. We profit by the war, you don't. So the great lords, the barons, from then on make an awful mess in England. And that's under, what's your name and so forth? Montfort, Simon de Montfort. They become greedier than ever. And this is what happens here. They grew proud because they were lifted up in their hearts because of their exceeding great riches. Therefore, they grew rich in their own eyes. They would not give heed to their words and walk uprightly with God. Who was Helaman to speak to us? We'll go our own way. So big trouble begins with our 46th chapter. We're starting out now very appropriately and in a on a timely theme. And I say this chapter alone, this 46th chapter that follows now, so compact, so rich it is with detail, all related and so forth, it alone would prove the Book of Mormon. So what did they do? Well, they felt threatened. They felt their wealth threatened. They formed an opposition party, feeling threatened. And what's more, this is the Central American pattern. They cracked down on the peasantry with hit squads. And they really meant business here. Notice it says, they gathered together against their brethren. They were exceedingly wroth, insomuch that they were determined to slay them. This was not just politics here. They wouldn't put up with this sort of thing, that they should have to, in their exceeding great riches, might feel threatened. And the leader of them, they found a strong leader, a Noriega in this case, somebody like that. You know, you all find the strong leader, the ruthless leader, and it was Amalickiah. And he was clever. He was a good man. He was a leader. He was sharp. Again, one of these character studies. Amalickiah is a marvel there. He has all this mixture of cunning, wisdom. He's clever. He's a good military man and so forth. And you see the flaw that runs through his character. A dangerous character. He was a dictator. Notice, he was desirous to become a king. Well, this is the thing now. These are the king men here. He's a typical military dictator, a type that is proliferated today. Of course, here, he makes a reflection on the next page, which is very much to the point here. And who was backing him? And those people who were wroth were also desirous that he should be their king. So they line up back of Amalickiah. Amalickiah is very good at organizing them. He organized together various conflicting groups and so forth. He brings them together in a common cause here. And they were the greater part of them. Notice ambitious lower officials, lower judges of the land, and they were seeking for power, upwardly mobile class. Seeking for power and ambitious, and this was the man to give it to him. And they had been led by the flatteries of Amalickiah. He promised them. He promised them they'd come to power, you see. Notice, he would make them rulers. This is the pattern. I mean, this is the classic pattern, not only Central America, European, modern, and so forth. And Brother Joseph has it all down, as I say, when he's still an adolescent. The flatteries of Amalickiah, that they would support him and establish him to be their king, then he would make them rulers. Well, that's what you do, you see. You make people ambassadors and department heads and cabinet members if they support you to put you on the throne. This is the pattern we follow in this country. And so they were led away by Amalickiah to dissensions, notwithstanding the preaching of Helaman didn't do any good. What if we were to take this first six verses? This would be a good subject for a final. Take these first six verses and put it in the form of, a McNeil-Lehrer report or Face the Nation or something like that. You have a council. They're discussing the situation, you see. This is the situation at that time. Well, what do you think is happening in the country now? Here we've just gone through the war and we finally made it by the skin of our teeth. Now we've had the post-war boom. What is all the trouble happening in the country? Who do you think is responsible? What do you think Amalickiah's chances are? Well, he's getting a lot of people now, but he can't hold on. Oh, can't he, though, and so forth. You could have an argument going on, typically in the way that we argue today around the table with things like these programs, morning, noon, and night, that go on, and discuss some of them, I say, like Neil McLaren on a pretty high level. And you would discuss this thing. Not what are Amalickiah's chances, what do you think's behind him? How can he count on wealth? Well, what can Helaman do? He's the head of the church. Alma's the chief judge and so forth. But Helaman is the head now. What are Helaman's chances? Well, they're pretty good, but what about the lower judges? You'll have one of them on the panel, you see. And he defends Amalickiah, and so he's important. He wants to get the country moving ahead. He doesn't want it dragged down. This equalitarianism, and we go on. But you can see all sorts of arguments are possible. Now here is Goering's promise and Hitler's promise. He would make them rulers over the people. Goering used to fire up the Hitlerjugend and get them all fired up by saying, we are going to rule the world, and you can all be governors and rulers somewhere, and you can hunt tigers in India and all that sort of thing. He promised them this is the sort of thing. We promise to make you rulers. We'll be the master race. The English had been doing it before, and the Germans were just jealous. Now, I don't think they could ever be as nasty and efficient as the Indians were, as the English were, even after they got going. Because once you win, you settle down and become more humane. But the British, you should see them in action. They don't fool. You wouldn't keep a member with a thin line like that. You wouldn't hold an empire for 100 years if you didn't crack down relentlessly, ruthlessly. Seen them do it time and again. Thus they were led away to thinking that there would be something. Notwithstanding the preaching of Helaman, see, don't you think Helaman's preaching will bring them around? No, that'll never bring them around. And his brethren, notwithstanding their exceeding great care over the church, for they were high priests over the church. There were many in the church. Ah, yes, say, but the church at least will hold out. Oh, no. The church is yielding. The church is collapsing before this post-war boom here that has everybody raked in. There were many in the church who believed in the flattering words of Amalickiah. You notice they found the political and economic arguments more interesting and more persuasive than the religious arguments. Religion is all right in its place and so forth, but unless you believe in the gospel all the way, that it is real and that that is the law by which we are to live on the earth, that nothing else will do it, absolutely not. I would recommend reading the teachings of Joseph Smith, Brother Joseph Fielding's edition of that, but notice it was the political and economic arguments that get to them, and that gets to people too, and then you want to take sides. That's easy to argue about. Everybody's an economist, you see. Everybody knows the politics at this, such and so forth. But we are pushovers for this sort of thing, and Amalickiah knew it. Great psychologist too. Therefore, they dissented. The church people started dissenting too, even from the church. And thus were the affairs of the people of Nephi exceedingly precarious. It had this sudden reverse after the war, when everything seemed to be going so well and so forth. And of course, this was utterly exasperating. They thought they had it made. Now we can settle down, and the war is won, the world is safe for democracy and so forth. But it never turns out that way. Notwithstanding their great victory which they had over the Lamanites, and their rejoicing, their great rejoicing, which they had because of deliverance from the hand of God, right in the middle of the celebration, the whole thing collapsed. It goes sour. Imagine how they would feel about that. Well, this happens again. Remember, it was just within 10 years, 1929, 1918, within 10 years of the armistice came the Great Depression. The whole country just collapsed. They just fell like the leaves of an ambrosia jumping from the windows in Wall Street. And I well remember that, too. And here is Alma's reflection on it, and it's a marvelous one. This, we get it philosophical here. Joseph Smith talks about the brethren this way. If you have a Bible, the first chapter of Ecclesiastes, yeah, bring it here, it's marvelous. He's reflecting, what does all this mean? Speaking about our round table discussion and so forth, it says here, thus we see how quick the children of men do forget the Lord their God. This is the way we're made. How quick they to do iniquity, to be led away by the evil. And today we also see the great wickedness of one how great wickedness one very wicked man can cause to take place among the children of men. Well, of course, we think of Hitler and Stalin there. One man, there were one man shows, you see. And the infinite wickedness and mischief they were able to do, they weren't the only men. Because the most skillful of all stay in the background. You never hear of them. We could a tale unfold about things like that. But the fact is that one very wicked person can do an awful lot of damage, as Satan does. So we can see how it happens. But we see the world. Oh, did you put the Bible up here? Oh, I thought you... Oh, you were looking it up. Well, good. For you can just... All of Ecclesiastes, anything you want. But the first, it shows you what the situation is. What can you do after all, is what it says. Let me have your Bible, will you? I was going to, but my Hebrew Bible is such a massive thing, it bears me down. Oh, this is it. He says, hi ho, vanity of vanities. We all know this one, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities. It's all vanity. There's nothing to it. What profiteth a man if all his labor which he taketh under the sun? What good is it going to do you, your career? You see, we're careerists today. It means you reach the top of the ladder and then you go nowhere. You have nowhere to go. There's some very sad things about this. You know, one day, everybody's kowtowing and you're no longer chairman of the board. You come to the office the next day and they say, who are you? You find your desk has been cleared out and so forth. Studs Terkel has written a very interesting book about these men. He interviewed top executives who suddenly reached the top and then were released, and the next day went to their office and were thrown out. They weren't even recognized. These men, everybody was licking the boots the day before. This is the way we do things. So all this labor under the sun. One generation passes away and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The show goes on, same as ever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down and hasteneth to its place where he arose. The great ode of Catullus on that. Soles occidere. Soles occidere et redire possunt. The sun rises and the sun sets and the sun rises again. Nobis semel cum brevelix looks cum cadet brevelix. No, nobis cum semel cadet brevelix looks. But once our little brief light goes out, una est nox perpetua dormienda. Nothing remains for us but one long night of nothing. The sun goes up and the sun comes down. But for us, how negative. You see, now that's the philosophy of the Romans. The Romans were a materialistic civilization. They lived for that. That's all they had to look forward to. So what a world we're in. I say, nothing gives you comfort like the Book of Mormon. You won't find this cynicism in the Book of Mormon, but you will find this. We're to blame for the whole thing. This is because of the foolishness of men. How quick children are men to do. I mean, they don't have to act that way. And how quick to do iniquity, how quick to forget. The great wickedness, one very wicked man. We're prone to wickedness, we're very vulnerable to all sorts of foolishness, and we go. And so he goes on. And the wind goeth south and turneth unto the north and whirleth about continually, and the wind turneth again according to its circuits. The rivers all run to the sea, yet the sea is not full. And he goes on. All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. We all sit before the idiot box, you see, and it just goes on and on. We never get anywhere at all. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done again. See this sad Book of Mormon story. Isn't it sad that it's all going to be repeated over and over again? This happens then. It's happening now. Must we go through with it? Well, is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath already been told of old time, which has been before us. So we do have recurrent events, and we do go round and round the cycle here. There is no remembrance of former things, and they all forgotten. They're swallowed up. How quickly we do forget, so that we can live our own generation. But neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come after we have been here. So, and the preacher was the king over Israel. It was King Solomon. He says, we used to talk about Buddha. You see, we talk about Enos. And it says here, I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning the things which are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to exercise it in. It's a rough road here. It's supposed to be. Does he understand? Again, the Book of Mormon has the excellence. Of course, it goes into the subject. Again, you're right on that. See, this time of probation, this time of testing, it's supposed to be that way. And yet it can be a happy time, too. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Solomon's fed up with his 400 wives and his most beautiful of palaces and magnificent temple and so forth, but he's like the rest of them. You're not going to get it here, he says. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. That which is wanting cannot be numbered if it isn't there. I communed with my own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate. I have gotten more wisdom than all they who have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart hath great experience and wisdom and knowledge. And of course, that was his foolishness. He thought he was so wise that the Shunammite, this clever woman, made a monkey of him. The Queen of Sheba, of course, in the story of Bilqis and King Solomon, the great epics in Arabic, the Queen of Sheba, she ties him into knots with her clever riddles and so forth. She's so much smarter than Solomon. He's ashamed of himself. He really lows him down. And that's the same thing with the Shunammite in the Hebrew tradition. I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this is also vexation of spirit. You want to find that out? So, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. So let's enjoy the great ignorance we're reveling in at the present. Thank you very much. See, the time is up. And on this happy note, we will continue. But I say it again, we need the Book of Mormon.